You got your beer?
I don't have a drink, but that's okay. I got my notes. I got my buddy Richard here. Welcome to another episode of the Render Bar. This one we're doing a little differently via Zoom. We are trying to spit one out in between some editing on another episode. And my name is Steve Jacks. I got Richard Sanchez here. We are two VFX editors working in Hollywood and features and television, here to talk to you about all things visual effects, editing, and industry-related news. So how was your day today? How's work going for you?
You know, it's good. It's kind of like with most shows, you spend the first few weeks getting your sea legs, which is always an interesting thing. I'm sure you've discovered this, Steve, as I run into it as well, is we've been through the ringer. We know what's expected of us. We know we can do the job. And yet sometimes you hit the new job and you go, this job isn't like the last one. I don't know what I'm doing.
100%.
And, you know, it's funny because sometimes the imposter syndrome kicks in and you just go, you know, like it can be hard to step back and go, you know what you're doing. Yeah, the first month or so is always a little crazy.
Are you feeling that now?
To a certain degree, yeah. Working on a show that I'd been a part of in a previous season, it's easy to go into it and go, I know what I'm doing. It's going to be exactly the same as last season. And, you know, the reality of that usually kicks in pretty quickly in terms of not really, you know, new software comes out, new techniques come out, and new teams are involved in the project. So, you know, there's always a little bit of going back to square one.
Yeah, that's always frustrating when you're expecting it to be the same and then it isn't. And then your brain, you have to train your brain to accept the changes and the differences when your instincts say no and just want to do it the same as I did before because it worked. Or even if it wasn't really that great, you just know what you're doing and it's easy to walk into a project doing it the same way you've always done it.
And I think there's value in looking to how you've done it in the past because you've done it in the past. It worked well. So you take the lessons of that past show and go, well, when and where we don't have to reinvent the wheel, let's not and make it easy. But then when those areas come up where it's simply not being done the same way, you go, okay, well, at this point, we don't have a roadmap, so we'll figure this out, and that's fine. It's all good.
Yeah, you know, that's how it is on my project, too. I'm working with a lot of the same people, and it's nice to be able to just keep doing what you're doing. And, of course, you have a lot of roadblocks with new formats, new technologies, new processes, and, of course, some new faces and new workflows. But for the most part, when the shows I've been on with this team, we've been able to continue with the process that works the best. And it's been nice just kind of showing up and getting your work done. It's I talked to some of the editors I work with, and we've all kind of agreed this is the closest to like a company job we've ever had.
Yeah,
working with
that's
the same,
funny.
Working with Lucasfilm for now like 6 years on these shows where every, you know, you worked out a lot, you ironed out a lot of the kinks years ago. It's nice to get to just show up and get to work.
Now, here's a question for you, because I know on previous shows, we, like many shows, worked on old versions of Avid because there's the comfort of the familiar. Of course, I'm referring to 2018, which many people have been on for a long time. And on this show, we've gone from 2018 to 2024, and the difference is absolutely staggering. There are things I don't like, but the speed of exports and whatnot is amazing. Are you using 2024? Are you on, or at least a newer version?
I think I'm on 2023, but yeah, we have the same. I think on Skeleton Crew, we jumped over to the 2024. And yeah, there was a definite change. There was a hiccup. There was a grace period for us to all get used to the new workflow.
Yeah.
One thing, the biggest thing was, all of our export settings are different.
Yes.
So same as source. It's a little different now. They just changed the names of the containers, you know.
It effectively doesn't exist. You have to force a template, which at first is weird, but not the end of the world once you get it done.
Once you get it done, you save your output setting and you're good. I don't even think about it anymore.
But the difference being that compared to last season, some of our episodes would take 30 to 40 minutes to export. Now it takes 8. It's like, I'll take
amazing.
That.
Well, yeah, especially for on your end, like on episodic, we do a lot of exports for the full episode, even for visual effects. On a feature, we're doing by sequence only.
Yeah.
So we're not, you know, we aren't at the place yet of exporting full reels. for VFX.
But speaking of episodic, one thing that is different is we are working with crews abroad, and that actually brings me to something I said in our last episode, and I actually got a little feedback from a listener about that. This comes to us by way of Jack Brown. Jack Brown is a friend of mine via Facebook. He also goes by the Avid Assistant Editor. He puts out amazing YouTube videos. All around generous, helpful, and smart guy. But he wanted to say that just to update things as to the state of things in the UK, as the talk in the episode seemed optimistic, and while yes, things are slowly coming back, it's still extremely bleak. Some editor friends that he knows who cut on things like Rogue One and Rings of Power have been out of work for a long time. I mean, those are huge shows. That is certainly a statement. He says, the guild has started to recommend counseling for members as the vast majority of us are not working, and a good number of people he knows have essentially given up and left the industry for something else. I mean, that's just something that I just have to get on record and say, I have so much sympathy for you. Yeah, that's rough. And so many people I know, so many very talented people I know here are dealing with the same thing. He brought up the fact that in general, there's not a ton of VFX editors in the UK. I guess the specialty of that particular position is just not quite as prevalent. And I mean, even stateside, I mean, it's a very niche job, but it was interesting to hear him say just it's with its lack of prevalence that makes sense why you're finding less people available, and those who do the job, especially on larger VFX shows, are unavailable. But he insisted that as we're all feeling how difficult it is right now with the lack of work, people are struggling in the UK. And certainly, I want to be very forthcoming here and to all of our listeners in saying I certainly did not mean to diminish anybody's struggle or imply that it wasn't difficult, because I know it's so difficult for so many people right now. And I want to be very respectful and very sensitive to that.
Of course, but I'm surprised. I didn't realize that UK, so what, that's just a position that isn't as common there?
Well, I know one thing that does happen with a lot of projects is American productions that bring American editors there will often bring across their American first, and that can be very difficult at times for folks. And I know that's also something that I hear from folks in Canada as well, is a lot of folks in Canada have talked about the difficulty of getting moved into the editing seat because a lot of productions bring an American editor and an American first assistant editor. And so, what jobs become available to those locals is sometimes it tends to not be the editor and the first assistant editor. So if you're talking about a local second assistant editor, or other position, that's effectively what you get a higher prevalence of.
That's very similar to whenever I was working in New York City. And all these big projects would come in town, but it's hard for a lot of the locals to get on them because of the LA crews that come to New York. So the editor would bring their first, right? Maybe you can get hired as a second or as an apprentice, but you're unlikely to get hired as a first because they would have their own editor or a VFX editor, perhaps that they would bring out. You're kind of like, it's a double-edged sword where the team is bringing on the best people for the job, but at the same time, you're bringing that workers from the outside to New York, and then those people can't work their way up and learn from people who are doing it because, or even get the chance to do it because don't even get the chance to get hired. And it's kind of similar to everything we're going through right now, where jobs are being taken, or jobs aren't even there, or jobs are going to get replaced by other, AI or machines or whatever. And then people aren't even getting the chance to learn or grow because this, it's better off to bring in, I've heard shows that are just going to Ireland because it's cheaper to bring ev ship everybody out on some game show than to just hire locally.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up New York too, because I know domestically that is a very sensitive issue as well, and I know it comes up often in the union forums. I know there is very much this sense of folks feel that New York is treated lesser than the West Coast, than Los Angeles, and certainly that's another thing that I want to be very very blatant in saying. I have full respect for New York editorial teams. I mean, I can think of a few right off the top of my head that I dream of working with. I mean, the Coens, Trisha Cook, love their work, and I still dream of getting into their cutting room one day. And our East Coast brothers and sisters, you are one of us, and I never want them to feel forgotten. I know it's a small town, and I get it. I think if I lived in the East Coast and I'm looking out for work and someone comes into town and they bring their whole crew, yeah, I'd be pissed off. I get it.
Yeah, I mean, and I know that the editors and assistants who come to New York have a lot of experience because they've, most of the big, sh all the big shows are, well, anymore, all the big shows were sh shooting and cutting here in LA.
Yeah.
And when all those crews come to New York, there's the level of experience is only so much if a lot of the assistants are only used to working on small independent films.
Yeah. You and I, Steve, got our starts as VFX editors by being an assistant editor doing everything. For myself, it was on a feature for Netflix called Naked. And for you, I believe it was I, Tonya.
Yeah, it was
Yeah. The
Itanya where there wasn't they wouldn't hire a VFX editor, just budget-wise,
So you're
And I
doing it
became the de
all.
facto VFX editor because I didn't know how to even manage that. I didn't even know how to say, well, I need a VFX editor. My post supervisor said, well, how long do you need a VFX editor for? I'm like, I can't say that. I don't know. I don't do
Yeah.
schedules and budgets. That's not for me to decide.
Yeah.
That's above my pay grade to say we need someone for 8 weeks. Like, you need
Yeah.
it for the whole sh the duration of the show,
Yeah, it is kind of what it's funny to hear that is how long do you need one? I mean, you don't need one for 2 weeks typically. That reminds me of a friend of mine recently was talking about how in an interview he was asked how long would it take for you to turn over 100 shots. And as I thought about that and as he was describing it, I was like, yeah, I mean, that's a question that is not, you can't just answer how long does it take to turn over 100 shots. I mean, if we're talking about split screens where it's literally just plate A, plate B, and nothing else, I can turn over 100 shots in one afternoon. But if we're talking about shots where you have multiple references and I need to find clean plates and I need to find balls and refs, I mean, the kinds of shots that have, you know, seven, eight elements per shot. Well, yeah, 100 shots could take 2, 3 days. That could take almost a week in some cases.
It's one thing to say how many new shots that you've received from the vendor can you cut in an
Yeah.
hour? That's one thing to say,
Yeah.
But it's different to say, well, how many pulls can you do in an hour? Because it all depends on the shot.
Absolutely.
Jack Brown, thanks so much for reaching out to us. We love listener feedback and hearing what everyone has to say. We'd love to hear what everyone else is thinking and feeling in regards to VFX editing, in regards to the industry, in regards to thoughts, fears. How's everyone doing out there? I know that lately something for me is just trying to keep that balance, that work-life balance. Something that I've been going through this year is like trying to get healthy again, get back into shape, and actually like be more regular, like taking care. I'm 41, and realizing like I'm hearing that the new midlife crisis is seems to be getting in shape or like taking care of yourself. Let's just say that. So I've been really trying to manage, working all day, but like still getting a couple work like 3 to 4 to workouts a week in the morning. And for me, the best way to do it is to wake up first thing and get going and find a new routine. I read this book, Atomic Habits. It's really, really helped for, and I think that can work for anybody for any kind of new habit they're trying to break or create. And that can go as well with what we do in editing, trying to learn a new program, trying to balance the crazy stress of a job with your personal life. And I found really great ways to be able to feel more, feel better about myself and feel better about who I am, about my body, and about, just being healthy. Because I know Richard, working in this industry can be not only soul crushing, but body crushing and mind draining, where
100%.
You're just sitting in a desk all day long. Maybe you stand occasionally, or maybe you have the standing desk, but you never actually
Ooh.
put it up.
I feel
And
attacked.
no, I have a standing desk and I have to remind myself to stand up. It's tough, man.
Yeah.
And it's easy to not really take care of yourself whenever you're just grueling those hours and trying to get it out. And if you have people above you that are demanding, you know, the
Yeah.
schedule's demanding, your editor's demanding, or your producers are demanding, the director's demanding. Not everybody has, you know, because I've had my share of shows that were really stressful. And it's easy to just let everything else go and say, well, everything I do is the work. Everything I do is work. And I
Yeah.
think one of the reasons why, like, you and I are doing this is because we're two people who would agree that there's more to life than just going to work all day and working in this industry.
100.
But when you're in it, it can feel like everything else doesn't matter, and I have to push away my bills, my mail. I can't take care of that dentist appointment or doctor appointment. I just got to work, and working is the only important thing.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing to be driven because I'm sure you experienced this early in your career when, when you're younger, it's perhaps easier to put everything off. I have the energy. I can work 16 hours a day. I can put off my doctor's appointments. It doesn't matter. I wanna work on bigger projects, and that's cool, but you will eventually hit the wall when you realize just how unhealthy that is. And then, you're in your mid-30s and you're like, I am absolutely exhausted. And as sometimes I think back on my friends who've like, I went to Thailand and I went traveling, and I go, that sounds amazing. I want to do that. I've
Why can't I do that? And then you
yeah
think, why can't I do it? And you're like, well, you can.
yeah
It's just a little bit of reprioritizing what matters
yeah
most to you. And then, you know, I think for me, it's like I hit 40 and realize there's a lot more to life than this. And some of it's, yeah, you see friends who are traveling, you see friends with families, you see friends who are doing this. Some of that's keeping up with the Joneses and trying to feel like, oh, I don't have grass is greener. But the other half of it is like, what do you want in your life? You know? Some people are so driven that they're at full. I think what it is, it's like, what's your identity? Is my identity tied to being an
Yeah.
editor? Or is my identity someone who wants is a try tries to keep healthy, tries to have a balance with friends and work and family?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, though, is because so many people, and certainly myself very much included, have tied their work and their ambition to their identity. And I th that's also a dangerous thing, especially in times like this when work is so few, because when all you identify with is an editor or the movies and there is no work, well, if I'm not an editor, what am I? I'm nothing. And I've dealt with bouts of that before too. Even coming to grips with the fact that I can just accept this as a job and not feel like it's my entire life. Just saying that out loud to myself made me think, have I lost my passion? And if I've lost my passion, I shouldn't be here. Because someone will surpass me. And even, that's one of those things you must acknowledge, that there is either somebody better than you right now, which there's somebody better than both of us right now, and that's okay. And
And
but you know what?
you're someone's better than us, and we're better than someone else. It goes both
And
ways.
we can continue to strive for excellence, but we don't have to be just that, and it's totally cool to, for one night, you don't have to watch the latest movie. You don't need to be able to be up on, the current industry trends. Just put it away and enjoy yourself.
Like you said it, you had a great point. How much is it tied to your identity? And in these times, if those of you who aren't working and are stressed and feel like everything's crumbling down because you've associated everything about yourself with the job, with editing, with assistant editing or visual effects editing, and if you aren't doing that, then you feel like a failure, or you maybe you feel like maybe just lost, right? And it's hard to even say pivot to another job because how co I can't, like, it's impossible to do anything else. When I've noticed the times you shift and say, well, there's a lot of other things in my life that are important to me, not just editing, right? And those are the times you're able to shift focus and reprioritize what's important to you. And then your core of who you are is less about the job and it's more about what the job represents. Maybe the job represents being creative. Maybe the job represents collaboration. Maybe it represents being social with other people or putting a puzzle together as far as editing is concerned, you know, like forming something out of nothing. So there's a lot of ways to reshift what your identity is than just it's the job. Because if the job's gone, then it feels like you have no identity.
Very much so. Like the difference between you don't have to be an editor in total. That can be just a part of you. You can be a person who edits. I am a an average Joe, and I also have this pretty cool job. That's pretty cool. And I think there is something to be said too. Like again, not to diminish. Like I feel so fortunate that I'm not working in a bank or something, you know, or doing investments or selling real estate, you know. That's cool. And I'm not diminishing anyone who does that. We need to buy houses. We need to build wealth, but. I feel privileged to say, hey, I mean, hey, that's cool. I'm going to do this thing for 8 months, 12 months, and then, hey, we're going to put it on the screen. Do you want to check it out? That's pretty cool, you know. But then being able to just separate that for a moment and just go, you know, because that is the freelance hustle, you know. Like we all know, there's going to be. We've all had those ebbs and flows, but this is a nasty flow,
And
you
hold
know.
on, let's pray that it keeps going, that work keeps going and bounces back, but also that Hollywood stays in Hollywood. Let's hope that's keeps happening. And yeah, I mean, with everything happening and with I think it was like I was listening to Josh Johnson. Do you know the comedian Josh Johnson?
I don't.
He is a correspondent on The Daily Show right now, but he's big on YouTube. He's been putting like pretty much every stand-up routine in full, almost in full, on YouTube on his channel. His latest one he did was about education and schools implementing AI in the classroom for teaching, and how it's like we're seeing AI almost attack like so many different jobs. And in the way that I'm, you know, it's jokes. He does jokes that are also poignant, that have a message, that are also kind of just thought-provoking, you know, and to think more about something using comedy. And part of it's like teachers already don't get paid enough, but yet now we want to, you know, have computer intelligence take their jobs. Right, or at least assist in teaching kids, and the kids won't even have the chance to talk to a teacher about, hey, I don't really understand. Can you further elaborate? And I think about that with how much I use ChatGPT lately in learning something, or how much we're seeing AI filter into editing, you know, in Adobe Premiere. I haven't tried it, but I was watching a YouTube video about it, which was this generative extension tool. Where you know that you know your shot cuts and you don't have any more footage, but you want it to keep going. So you can like extend it and then it automatically generates new frames based on what it's seeing, right?
I heard someone talking about this, and they were talking about it in context of a documentary, and I couldn't help
Was
but
it the eye blinks?
yes.
Yeah, we watched the same thing. Okay, so the situation was, oh, I don't want to, I hate cutting on a blink. I don't want him to be blinking when I make this cut. And my first thought is, well, just trim it back a couple frames. Like, it seems pretty simple. But I'm sure there are reasons why they wanted to, you know, have the cut where it was, but him not blinking. And then it feels like, well, now you're doing a visual effect. But instead of calling it a visual effect, you're saying, I'm going to use AI to alter the image of the person, especially for a documentary.
That's the scuttlebutt for me. By nature of editing a conversation, you are now taking something out of context. Any edited interview is inherently a manipulated context. We can, yes, that's fair. But yeah, I gotta admit, it feels to me like that is starting to toe the line in terms of what you ethically should and shouldn't do on something that presents itself as fact.
It is, especially for documentary, where you are purporting this to be a documentation of reality or some type of reality, right? Some real moment. And altering it seems like, yeah, like you said, it kind of defeats the purpose of what you're doing.
In terms of, again, any interview, you're going to cut it down for length. You're going to cut it down because people have a tendency to ramble, or maybe they use a lot of us or you knows. You got to cut
Sure.
all that down.
That's
But,
editing, though.
yeah, exactly. But there's a case to be made. It's a blink. Okay, is that's not the same as literally using like an AI voice to say something they didn't say. That would be largely unethical,
Yeah.
especially in a doc,
That's a whole different, that's another topic, but in terms
but
of
it's sort of
editing
it's
tools,
the gateway into that.
it is. And it's interesting because I get sucked into it as well, like using Photoshop. I can extend this background. I can find a, especially if you're doing a temp comp or something, you can get sucked into it, and you got to be careful because, say you use generative AI and Photoshop to create a new background for your temp, but then now your director likes it. But wait, where'd you get it? Can you replicate it? No. But now you may be asking a vendor to replicate an AI image, right? So it gets a weird, tricky spot. And that's not something I'm doing, but it's something I was dabbling with and realizing that, well, wait, you can't, just use this because if, you may think of it as a temp, and it's not, I think it's the idea that the AI is so good in certain ways that it tricks you to realize this isn't a temp. This is more than a temp, right? This background looks too good. It solves the problem. Well, oh, I want to s tell the story beat better, but it actually is causing another problem. Whereas if your vendor isn't using AI, then you really can't be throwing that stuff in the mix. And not until vendors are using AI to create something that they have their own approved version of AI to use that you're all in collaboration using together, it's really not a good idea to be using that as a temp and then passing it along to the vendor.
A big part of being a visual effects editor is turning over all of your elements. And so when we build a clean plate out, there's something to be said about as much time as it takes for us to find all those pieces and build our clean plate. We can then present those elements to the vendor and say, well, yeah, that was a nasty clean plate. I actually had to combine four different pieces in order to make it. But if I give you these pieces, you can replicate this because this is what I used.
Like you get the
Whereas with
source. Yeah.
precisely, whereas with AI, oh, yeah, I used this and it just generative filled. And okay.
Yeah, 'cause it's a really cool tool, and you feel like you can accomplish the you can solve a problem and get a really cool result. So it feels like you've jumped a lot of steps by yourself, right? And it seems similar to like whenever I would make a video for myself and use copyright music. I'd be like, oh yeah, sounds awesome. But you're cheating because you can't use that. If it's well, depending on the situation, right? But you know what I'm saying? Like if you want to go say, I made this, but you never got any of this music cleared, it's not yours. You don't have the rights to use it. It seems a little similar, but like, yeah, AI created it, but I don't really don't have the right to show this or use this because it what is, who does it belong to? Right? Does it belong to me? Does it belong to, say, Photoshop? I have a friend who uses AI to create music for his YouTube videos to get around copyright, which sounds like a great idea. And maybe it's fine, and maybe a lot of other people are using it, but I haven't seen it outside of my friend. And the idea is, it's you can prompt the lyrics, you can prompt the tone, you can prompt his music style and everything, and it's very specific. It can be very as specific to your video as you want it to be. Which can sound kind of like funny or cool because their lyrics are specifically about what you're doing in the moment in the song. But then who owns it? Do you license it? Like, I don't really do that. I've tried it once, but like, are you licensing it? Do you then own the license to that song? Or does that song just exist in their library? and they own it,
Yeah.
and they could come back to you saying, oh, actually, we my prog our program made it, right?
Yeah.
So that's a tricky thing, and it's scary because I'm seeing it, you're seeing it, we've been seeing it with AI generated text, AI generated images, now video, and now we're seeing how it's manipulating pre-existing footage.
Yeah, the analogy I always feel like I use with AI, especially with regards to the ownership, is it, I think back to a 19th century wealthy person commissions an artist to point paint a portrait of their family. Now, that person paid an artist to paint their family. And you would say, well, I commissioned this painting, but you wouldn't say, I made this painting. And I feel like that's kind of the thing that AI is going down the route. And I will admit, I get really cranky when I hear AI artist, and it's like, yes, I understand you had to really figure out this prompt in order to get this really specific image. That sure, that took work, but the work that that took, I'm sorry, I'm gonna say it, it's not art. The work that was taken to type that prompt out is not art, and it's not being an artist. And the computer is the artist in that case. And I think that's it to me, it's the same thing. It would be, hey, Steve, I paid you $100 to paint a portrait of my family. And then when my family comes over, I would say, I'm the artist, but I'm not the artist. Like,
Well,
that's.
devil's advocate for a moment, because say if we're saying that typing in prompts is not art, someone who writes poetry is an artist as in a writer. And say if AI art or images are at the mercy of the prompt, someone who is not good at writing prompts will get a subpar result. Someone who is very good at writing prompts may get a very an incredible, amazing result. So, is there any artistry in the prompt?
Well, I would say because a poet, for example, puts words together in a specific order. But those words have to go through the reader's mind and be interpreted. And it's that interpretation wherein lies the beauty and experience of the art. And I still think the prompter is passing something off, but the computer is doing the interpreting. And so I've always felt like the old argument as to people who say that books are inherently better than movies, which is, I'll just go on record and say I disagree with that assertion. There are certainly instances where it does or doesn't. But the beauty of a book is those are words, and in your imagination, it can be whatever your imagination is. But what's fun about a movie is it brings it to life, and but it is someone else's interpretation. It's gone through their filter. And so at what point when it where the abstract becomes tangible, that is through the lens of the director, the director's vision. And in this case with AI, you are saying it's you're feeding ideas to a computer. The computer interprets it and makes this image. But I think it's like a screenwriter creates art in their script, but the script by itself is something that is read and interpreted by the viewer, and so it has to be filmed and translated into real life to become the finished film. So this. Not saying that a script by itself isn't art, it is art, but that is not a movie, that is the first step in it. Does that make
I mean, that's
sense?
similar to, like, say, a director shooting all this footage, and then they're going to put it into a computer and say, okay, computer editor, here's all the footage, and I'm going to prompt with all the ideas I have for these scenes. Spit me out a movie, right? Or spit me out a scene. It's similar in that, like, well, there's no editor, so who's really doing it? Who's the artist in the editing process? And same way, if you're prompting, well, there may be quote artistry to the prompt in how creative you can be and detailed you can be. It isn't without its trial and error as well, but also without, you may write the prompt, but you can't say anyone I actually created the image. So it is that interesting thing of like, well, you did the prompt. You may own the rights to the prompt, but do you own the rights to the outcome? That's something that's going to be interesting. I'm sure we'll see over the coming years. Who owns these images in reality, even if you write the prompt?
So I'll give into the analogy of the skill it takes to create a prompt. So you have a skilled prompt writer who feeds a prompt into one model, and that creates one image. Now you could then say this prompt writer is objectively a good prompt writer, but the result that that prompt writer will get from one model will vary from a different model. And so I think that's where then the argument becomes the model, the computer is the quote unquote artist, because as skilled as you are as a prompt writer, if you give that same prompt to a different model, you will get a different result.
And what if you did the same prompt on the same model, different day? Would you get the same result or a different result?
As models get more sophisticated, because I would imagine that models are always learning, they're always feeding upon new data. Sure.
Or just the idea of it's like you're putting your iPod on shuffle. Every time you hit shuffle, it's not going to do the same shuffle every time.
Correct.
It's a new
Correct.
shuffle. So the same prompt, different day. Anyone out there, if you've done this day after day, like different prompts, do you get the same result, or are you getting a different result every time? Because even when you do a prompt, it spits you, like Photoshop will give me three or four different options on that one prompt. And then I say, actually, this one, I like this one. So yeah, I think that already kind of answers that question, because there's no one r result to one prompt. It's many results to a prompt.
And the shuffle playlist is kind of a great analogy too, because as you said that, it made me, you know what it made me think of? It made me think of one of my favorite albums, Pink Floyd, The Wall, which is just such a beautiful story told in that record. And if you were to change the order of those songs, you would change the meaning of it. And that is critical.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what's, I think, just generally, well, recently I watched season one of ILM's documentary on Disney
Oh my
Plus,
God, it's so
The Light and
good.
Magic. Have you watched it?
So good.
Okay, so I got to the end of season one, and it's an episode talking about how Jurassic Park came out and the model shop basically died in a day. Like, it was that fast. The thought of, oh, we're still going to be around for a while. We see that the writing's on the wall, this, computer graphics are getting better and better, but we're still going to be around for a while. And then they do the dinosaurs, and suddenly it becomes so obvious and clear to so many people that that's the new method. That's the new way of the future. And I feel like 30 years later, we are in a very similar place where it feels like better get in on this AI because it's not going anywhere. And things are changing, and they're changing fast, and you can feel like, no, I'm going to keep doing my art the old-fashioned way by hand, or, well, no, everyone's doing it by prompts now, and it's the new thing. It becomes so acceptable.
I think it would be unwise to eschew AI just because, and certainly because it's not a human-made process. I think it'd be wise to be aware of what it does and how it can benefit you. The one thing I do think about, because thinking about both that documentary and the documentary Jurassic Punk, I wonder if AI is going to effectively put us in a creative feedback loop, in that AI was trained on films that have been made today and prior, which means it can only be as smart as today and prior. But I think back to how people innovated new processes, and in innovating new processes, made great new art. I mean, of course, with ILM, you have these motion control cameras to create these sweeping space moves in the original Star Wars, which 30 years later became computer graphics in Jurassic Park, at a time when they didn't think it was possible. And this artist, Steve Williams, said, "I'm going to build out every bone digitally and then put a skin on it." And they supplemented that with both practical effects and digital effects in a way that was very skillful. So They would use animatronics and puppets for close-ups, and they would use CG for the wider shots. Brilliant. Great way to acknowledge the shortcomings of CG at the time and benefit from models and puppets. And you're left with a film that was made in, what was that, 93, 94? That film
93,
still, it still holds up. I mean,
I recently watched, because I recently just finished reading The Lost World, because I had never read it before. So I finished reading that, and then I watched the film version. And there's some incredible, and that's 97, so The Lost World came out in 97, and there are some still amazing shots in that film. And it has the same blend of CG and creature work. It's the magic of it all, that you're creating something that isn't real, but you can tell it's not real. And because it's there's that weird, I don't know what it is, becomes you get a little fearful of it or intrigued by it. But when everything is digital, and it's crazy because working in VFX and being a VFX editors, to be critical of it at the same time, we love it because it is the playground of imagination. But at the same time, we've also seen that taking it too far loses the magic that we grew up with. To be able to see the creature and wonder, how do they even make that? Because knowing it's physically there, you can see it's physically there, actors are interacting with it, it's magic. But knowing that it's just all computer graphics, fake, you can see that it's not real. It's like a magician, right? You can see where the sleight of hand is happening. And you're like, oh, yeah, okay.
But you bring up a good point in terms of the, because the one thing I've always thought about with the eternal argument of practical versus digital, and it seems that conventional wisdom says that practical is always better than digital. And I would also like to say that I don't think that is always true, because if we're really honest, there is some pretty awful practical work, and we've all seen it. But I will say this is, I think the one thing that practical has over digital, practical has inherently more charm. And so, because practical has more charm, you're more willing to forgive less than the best practical because of that. And so, for example, of course, excellent practical is amazing and it's so great, but even subpar practical, there's that charm. Whereas with digital, great digital, Jurassic Park holds up and you'll love it. But bad digital, yeah, you see it and you go, this is, what the hell am I watching? And the example I always use is RoboCop, which also goes back to ILM and Phil Tippett. Phil Tippett, I have endless respect for him. But if we're being totally honest, the I think about when RoboCop shoots Ed 209 at the end of the movie with the Cobra gun, the head blows up and Ed 209 falls over, and the foot on his the toe is like kind of springs. But if you look at it, and it's fairly clear that just compositing techniques back then were not what they are now. The color doesn't really totally match. You know you're looking at a miniature, but damn it all, if that is not,
It
it's
still holds
just
up
such a
in a
great,
way. Yeah, it does hold
I
up
love
because
it.
you can tell that it's a mat. You see that they're using some sort of magic trick in a way that feels like, while it doesn't look, quote, real, photo real, you can tell that it's part of a story that's being told, and you can connect the dots in your imagination. Whereas, say, the remake of RoboCop using all the computer graphics, you got to work a lot harder on that story to
That
make
is
that
true.
story
That
really
is true.
shine if your effects aren't gonna
And
help it.
that's a good example too. I wasn't even thinking about that, because I think back to the scene in the new RoboCop where they pull away and you just see like the only human elements of RoboCop is like his face and his lungs.
Yeah, it's so
And
weird.
like, yeah,
But not like creepy weird, just like, what? You're more
I
like
didn't love
confused
it.
and you don't love it. And if you can see that, oh yeah, it's his face and they just green screened his body. But if they were able to make that shot practical, when things are done practically, you start to question where the line is. Because there's some trick there to make it seamless in physical form. When it's digital, you can just tell, and a lot of people are smart watching movies these days. They've seen computer graphics for 30 years now. You can see where the lines are.
And you know, that's a really good point too, is the audience now is smarter than ever. And I think it would have been wise for every filmmaker, even going back several years, to never underestimate the intelligence of your audience. And I think what differs about AI this time is when you go back to even, let's just go back as recent as 1993 with Jurassic Park. These kinds of 3D programs was not on everybody's computer. I guess back then it would have been like a Compaq or an eMachine. You didn't have the technology that ILM had on those computers back then. So it was still more of a mystery. But the one thing with AI is even though there are varying degrees of AI, people are already playing with ChatGPT. They're playing with Midjourney. They're playing with all sorts of AI tools. And so
Like
it's going to be
already on a
much harder.
consumer level, yeah.
Yes, and so it's going to be much harder to fool the audiences because they're aware of the smoke and mirrors because they have access to it, even if what they have access to is a much more primitive version of what the biggies, the big films are using, or what Google with Google's Veo 3 is using.
Oh yeah, tell me more about that.
So, Veo 3 is their newest model, and there was a recent
Model of what?
example.
Is it like an AI image engine or what is it?
It's a generative AI model, and so the big example that I saw was this shot of a off-road vehicle driving through this muddy river. But
Oh, I saw
the
that.
thing about it was the prompt was gargantuan. It was a long paragraph, and I was thinking, how long did that prompt take to write? Now, anyway you look at this, the time it took to write that prompt was much shorter than the time it would take to write a script, to get your locations cleared, to bring lights out to the bayou of Louisiana and get an off-road vehicle to drive there. Yes, of course, I will concede to all of that. But I was like, okay, it's interesting and it's cool. It looked good, but the one thing that jumped out at me is, yes, but you don't see people in it. And
Right.
what is critical to a film are characters you empathize with, characters you want to be, and so much AI has that telltale AI sheen. So a car is cool, but unless you can see that person and think of them as a human, it's going to be challenging. Now, I also want to say that's not to say that you can't empathize with characters who don't look human. I mean, for example, I mean, Pixar does it time and time again, where you have tons of empathy for these characters.
Even if it's just a film of a pet or a dog or an animal of any kind, even if it's real, you can still empathize with
Or,
that. Yeah.
I mean, I just recently watched Soul, which I still feel is one of those Pixar films that kind of flies under the radar. I feel like people don't talk about that film. That film is underrated. That
Yeah,
film
I haven't
is
seen it.
excellent.
I know it came out
I
during COVID,
bawled
so
like
that
a
could be why it flew
child.
under the radar,
Yeah.
unfortunately. Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, you, Steve, and
Okay.
you, anybody listening to this, I mean, that movie is underrated. I loved it. It's
Okay.
beautiful. If you're a musician, it captures having, I've played the upright bass since I was 15, and so I've certainly. There's this one scene where the character kind of gets into the zone and gets lost in the music, and it's a feeling that's hard to describe, but that film described it visually in a way that is like, that's what it's like when you're in the zone.
Cool,
You know,
cool.
the students are talking to him in his class and he can't hear them because he
Yeah.
is in the zone.
Well, I mean, that's what we do, right? What we do is getting in the zone. We are creative. We're cutting. We're even visual effects. We're like working on that comp. We are
Yeah.
making something. We're making that magic happen, and that's why we're
Yeah.
here. And that's what it's all about. It's getting in
Yeah.
the zone, creating something, having an idea, putting it together. And I feel that's the fear with AI of, oh, it's taking that away from all of us, of that the time it took me to learn editing as a kid and make a ton of mistakes just to get where I am, and for same as you to get where you are. But these tools now are kind of skipping a lot of those steps and just taking, I don't really have to learn much. I just got to write a prompt and like put something together and then put up on, have a generative editing software and just it all does it for me. And then, like, because if the result is I want a video, well, maybe you could do that. But do you want to? Life is more than just the result. It is the process and the journey of the mistakes and of the wins and the losses and figuring out what works and what makes you happy as you do it than just getting the result. It's not earned, you could say.
Well, and and on that note, I think there is a in the world of feature films and digital what's the term they're using now?
Content creator?
Yeah, the digital content creator
Yeah.
ecosystem. I think AI is going to be a boon for people in that space, and that's fine. And I think in features, it'll probably be there, but in a slightly different capacity. I think the expectation for a visually convincing image is just higher. And so it might take over some tasks. It might take over, and I mean, whole tasks over time.
Yeah, I can just see it in terms of if faster post-viz, faster pre-viz. Getting
Previs
like
is the.
I don't have to deal with the yes, we will have post-viz and pre-viz artists working on it, but using AI to create it might get more specific to the thing that we need rather than not as good. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we really want to try something very specific here. I can throw my model in and then I'm seeing it exactly how I want to see it, rather
I
than
will
an
admit,
approximation of it.
I will admit that for all of my friends who work in the previz space, I do worry for them the most because AI does exactly what previz, and that's not to say that previz is not also a very challenging craft because you have to take notes from your director and you have to accomplish what the director wants. But ultimately, the goal of previz is not to be completely photorealistic. You just need to sell the idea that they're going to go and shoot. And my thought is AI can do that as long as the prompts can support what the director is asking for and iterate upon that. That can be done. And
Maybe the better it
so,
looks, the better your previous cuts can be to actually understand the story better. Because I will say one thing, watching a previous cut where you get the idea, this is the thing that happened, this happened, like this story beat happens that followed by this, then this, then this. Okay. But to then say that, am I feeling the emotional beat here? Am I understanding the story? Am I understanding what the character's struggling in this moment? Maybe not as much, but you are understanding what happens in what order, right? So then you go to shoot it, and maybe that emotional through line is missing because while it was all there in previs, well, you didn't take it further, you couldn't have the time or the money to take it further to make sure that the story works before going to shoot it. That's what happens. A lot of these big films, they'll previs everything. They'll previs the hell out of the movie, but then they still have a bunch of problems. And then you wonder why, because, well, you basically made the movie already, but you didn't have enough time or budget to really hone that down and make sure it worked before going to shoot it. Because if you could do that, then you could solve all your problems. Then maybe movies could be better when you go to shoot it, because you've ironed out all the kinks, especially these movies like that rush their schedules.
It's AI is such a because AI can be done with less people, I think that also is going to it's going to pose a very interesting philosophical quandary, which is there's value in having an editor who will challenge their director. And so the director says, I want to do this, I want to do this. And the editor's going to say, I think we should do this. I really think you should cut that line. That line doesn't work. And so in a world where the editor, I'm just going to go extreme on this example and say the editor is removed from the process because the AI is doing that job and the director can have whatever they want and it is solely the director's vision with no external influence. That is not to say that there aren't some people who have very brilliant storytelling abilities, but I think that's going to be in the minority. And you will find that without having someone to stop and say, Steve, I love you, but you got to cut that line. It's not working.
And you have a director who cuts and writes and directs and edits their own films. That's not too dissimilar, but you hear your point. You do have people. You should, hopefully you're having people in your bubble, or your crew of people that are you are allowed to criticize and to comment and give that input, because that's what all
Yeah.
this is about, collaboration, you know.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
you look, are you excited for the future of AI, or are you worried that we're all gonna be doomed by the AI gods
You
and
know, I would say I'm neither excited nor doom and gloom. I think the genie is out of the bottle. It's never going back in, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think there's a couple of things that are going to happen that is going to determine how this plays out. One, how good will AI get? And it will certainly get better. And two, how willing are audiences going to be to drop their standards and accept things that don't look quite as good? Because as the quality of AI rises and as the audiences are willing to accept perhaps a lower quality product, and at a certain point, those two numbers will come closer together and intersect. That will determine how prevalent it becomes in use. There's plenty of questions of ethics, but if we're being really honest, I mean, the term Hollywood accounting is used tongue in cheek, but what does Hollywood accounting mean? It means people not getting paid. So ethics, let's be real here. Hollywood is not overly concerned about ethics. The artists who are hired by Hollywood are. I think there's something to be said about like industries that I think will see the effects of AI right away, Roto and Previz, without a doubt. I think there's cool things about that. I think if I could get Roto done with AI and give me a stronger sense earlier on, like, hey, I can do this really cool temp, that's cool. I'm not overly worried that I'm taking someone else's job away because it's effectively the
You would
Previz
have
that I'd
been the
be
only,
doing.
maybe the only VFX editor anyway.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
It's definitely exciting time and a worrying time and a confusing time. It's just amazing how, in such a short amount of time, change has been happening. All you can do is stay vigilant and keep up with it as best you can. And at the same time, when you
Yeah.
go back to the 90s and you see the model makers at ILM being so worried and either keep having to learn computer graphics or leave the job, those who can stick with it may be able to keep going, and those who can't have to go find something else. Or it's like, how much are you willing to keep up with the trend and the changes? And so hopefully it just means that a new wave of something interesting and new and exciting, and hopefully that's positive spin on it, that it'll make storytelling even better rather than worse. But you know, the future is yet to be seen, so.
Yeah, and I would also say, like, don't avoid it just because you don't like the idea of it. And it's totally okay to hate AI, just like plenty of people hated the transition from analog editing to digital editing. Totally fine. But try to keep an open mind as much as you can. You know, there's a friend of mine, a really great VFX supervisor. His name was Bill George. I worked with him on Bill and Ted Face the Music. And him and I, he came onto the project and we bonded because he worked on, I mean, so many projects that as a kid I was such a fan of. He built a model for One-Eyed Willy's ship from the Goonies. I mean,
Really?
I lost my mind seeing pictures
Wow.
of that. But talk about someone, he came up in the model shop and then he came on. He was our VFX supervisor and he was helping us build models for phone booths in Bill and Ted. And I was like, wow, man, this guy has gone from this high level of excellence in an analog world. And rather than say, screw that, I'm not going to be a part of it, well, just stepped up and did this. And it's your artistry and your what you bring to the table is that is valuable. And so The one thing I think with AI is, because I know sometimes I personally feel anxiety, like what AI should I be learning? And I don't even know that there's really not a right answer to that because it's still also early. So a lot of these companies that are big now, I mean, the big names you hear, the two biggest names I hear right now in AI are Flawless, which helps do redubbing and it moves mouths. It creates digital mouths so you can redub. You could like
Wow.
effectively change an R-rated film to a PG-13 by changing the F word to like frick or something, or you can do
Jeez.
international redubs. And then there's 11 Labs, which does voices. I mean, those products are cool, but like what happens with so many tech companies is these companies get a lot of they get a lot of early investors and I mean, they could be gone in a month, get absorbed by another company. So I think there's something to be said. It's valuable in knowing what AI can do. Play with whatever sounds interesting to you. If 11 Labs seems cool, play with it. I mean, just kind of go, okay, that's cool. Maybe 11 Labs will be something cool, and maybe it'll turn into Compaq. You know, I mean, when was the last time you heard that name? But at the time, it was the king of the world.
That's how I got my start in editing on my Compaq computer in my parents' basement, for sure.
And did you have a Pinnacle editing system
I
like I
did.
did?
Yeah, we've chatted about this before. Pinnacle editing system software, whatever, with the basic editing package, with my FireWire port 1394 I had to install into the
And I
computer.
think mine had RCA cables.
Probably did too. Mine did too. Yeah, man. It's
That I bought at
crazy, you know,
CompUSA.
it's not different than the guys that started ILM. You started in the 70s, very physical, analog. And then 20 years later, it's going digital. And now here we are, 30 years later, it's going AI. It's always going to change. And we live in a very strange time in history in which things are changing at a breakneck pace constantly. The world 100 years ago does not even re like barely resembles what we see today. So things are changing always, and it will keep changing. And that's the strange part about it, is to keeping up with that change. So the best you can do is keep up with it, but then at the same time, still criticize it like we are about, well, that's not editing. If you're using AI to change that eye blink, that's not editing. You know, so yeah, you can be hypocritical about it like we are, but you know, you kind of just got to keep up with it, I guess, as best
We're
you are able to.
open-minded curmudgeons.
Yes, open-minded curmudgeons. Yeah. I think on that note.
If you have a question or a topic that you'd like to hear us discuss on the Render Bar, feel free to reach out to us at our email at renderbarpod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.